Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertleben for Bob Kinzel. We are more than two centuries removed from the War of 1812, so it is somewhat understandable if most Americans think of it chiefly as the conflict in which British soldiers set fire to the White House, or maybe start humming Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, which was actually written decades after the war and commemorates Russia successfully defending the homeland against Napoleon. Those more inclined to a detailed historical overview point to the battles fought for control of water lanes on Lake Champlain. And our neighbors to the north can lay claim to bragging rights for turning back no fewer than three attempts by U.S. forces to invade and take over the city of Montreal. Our guest today has dug deeper into Vermont's role in the war, and specifically those Vermonters in communities not far from the Canadian border, in places like Swanton, that were strategically vital for the U.S. Army, even if the people who lived there were not necessarily supportive of the war campaign. Jason Barney has brought these lesser-known stories of the war to life in the new book, Northern Vermont in the War of 1812. Barney is a high school history teacher at Missisquoi Valley Union High School. He's been teaching there for the past 18 years, and before that, was a student himself at MVU. Jason Barney, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for that very kind intro to the book.
So, Jason Barney, let's start with the basics. It's been about a generation since the War for Independence with Great Britain, still at the time one of the world's great military powers. War breaks out yet again between what is now the U.S. and Great Britain. What was the chief reason the two countries went to war in 1812?
That's a great question. If you're looking at it historically, this is probably one of the conflicts in American history where there are a lot of questions about whether or not the war needed to be fought at all. When war finally does break out, something I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later on, a lot of people up on the Canadian border are not exactly in line with the rest of the country as far as not trading with England or Canada. And let's just say the definition of patriotism up here in northern Vermont is definitely tested.
And this all started because Great Britain was impressing, I guess that's not the word, but the impressment of U.S. soldiers by Great Britain, right? They were actually getting stopped on the seas and put onto ships.
The larger story is one of the Napoleonic Wars. And France and England had been fighting each other for decades. And then when the American colonies get their independence, there's this effort by American presidents, early American presidents, to try to keep America from becoming entangled in European conflict. And when Jefferson is president, he kind of tests the bounds of presidential authority. There are several laws that are passed which basically say we're not going to trade with England at all. And if you're in South Carolina or North Carolina, that really doesn't affect you unless you're on the coast. When you're up here on the Canadian border and Lake Champlain is basically a superhighway of trade and you have the Richelieu River going up to Montreal and Quebec, to not be able to trade with your neighbors to the north, not your enemy to the north, but your neighbors to the north, just doesn't fit any sort of it doesn't fit the local economy at all. So you had families who were engaged in the lumber trade, timber, potash, cattle. Once those laws nationally are passed, their markets have immediately been taken away. And if that sort of thing happened today, I think you would have people asking the question, what is the value of your patriotism? And you kind of have to put a dollar value to that, because if you can make more money by trading with somebody that you're not supposed to trade with, some people will do that.
You mentioned potash, one of the raw materials, I guess, that was frequently traded between Canada and Vermont. What is that exactly?
It's a long process when you have wood products burned down. There's a refinement to it, and basically potash ends up being used in glass products, dyes, soaps. And so with northern Vermont having so many trees, Montreal was just a natural market for that. And yeah, there were boats going in and out of Missisquoi Bay, up Lake Champlain by Alberg, and Canada was a primary market. So when federal law said no more trade with your neighbors to the north. There were people all along the border who looked the other way or actively participated in a little bit of behind-the-scenes action.
We can call it smuggling. I mean, that's what was happening, right?
Oh, yes.
I mean, all of a sudden they're being told, guess what? You can't have this lucrative trade that you're used to having with your neighbors, you know, just over the border there for, you know, decades perhaps. Now you can't do it anymore. So, yeah, there was smuggling going on, right?
The most notorious example that some of your listeners may already be familiar with is something called the Black Snake affair. The Black Snake is a smuggling ship that is operating through Missisquoi Bay to the west of Aalborg off North Hero. And it's basically a group of locals and some Canadians that own the ship. And on some runs, it's probably potash. On other runs, it's probably other products that they're trying to get over the border. And the customs officer, Jabez Penniman, up in Swanton, and working at Windmill Point in Aalborg, they're able to track down the Black Snake in a couple years before the War of 1812, and they follow it down to the Chittenden County area. And I believe the altercation actually happens in the area of the Ethan Allen homestead, but there are two or three deaths of the American militia members. And the folks who are operating the Black Snake, they're captured. They're all put on trial. And Cyrus B. Dean of Swanton gets a public hanging at Battery Park in Burlington.
People came out – you wrote about this in the book. People came out to watch that execution,
oh, yes.
As was, I guess, fairly common in those times.
It was a pretty big event, and I wouldn't want to quote the sources in front of me, but there are a lot of people who show up for it.
When you teach this to your students, are they surprised by things like that?
Well, so this is something actually that I want to teach to my classes. Thank you for mentioning the teaching. Back at MVU, one of the classes I teach is an Abnaki and local history course. And I would love to make the War of 1812 the focus of a unit. But as of the structure of the class right now, I spend a lot of time focusing in on Abnaki history, and right here just before Thanksgiving, I've done a lot of French and Indian War history. So if time permits, I will definitely develop some units about the War of 1812, but I don't want to be too selfish with my own influence in the classroom.
It is a fascinating topic, though. And let's talk a little bit more about tribes like the Abenaki, because Native Americans did play a role in this wider conflict. As you mentioned, the Napoleonic Wars, this was a really much wider conflict than just Britain and America. We're talking about Russia, France, Canada, and these Native American tribes. What kind of a role did they play?
Well, earlier than the War of 1812, the Abenaki are caught in the middle. You have the English colonies to the south, and you have the French colonies up around Quebec and Montreal. And the Abenaki are in Swanton and other locations throughout the Champlain Valley. As the British move north and as the French move south, the Abenaki get squeezed. And when you have another topic that I would love to write about, and I've done some research for the local history class, is just to what extent was the initial French settlement in Swanton? Probably after St. Anne Shrine is established by the French on Isle of Mott in 1666. At some point in time in the 1700s, the French are in the northern Champlain Valley. They have some villages up in Canada just north of Aalborg. And the Swanton history book has several references to a sawmill, maybe a stockade, and several groups of settlers being along the Missisquoi River. And they actually note members of the Abenaki tribe at that point in time. So for the War of 1812, the Abenaki were sort of not in the area at that point, or they just weren't part of the conflict and they were still in Swanton. But Abenaki history is very big up in Swanton, and it's really neat to be able to cover that with my students.
And we have Milton on the line from Swanton. Milton, hi.
Hello. I just want to relate some family history. My wife's family settled in Swanton around 1791, and during the War of 1812, they lived in Swanton, and a British soldier came into their home and took their musket rifle. This is the story that comes down. When the man of the family came back and found out that his musket had been stolen, he went out and he came back with the family musket and a British Army rifle. When my father-in-law died, I gave the family musket to the Swanton Historical Society. His brother-in-law was given the British Army rifle, and I have no idea where the Army rifle is today, or I should say Army musket, but anyway, that's the family story.
That's a great story, Milton. Thank you for that historical perspective. And I wonder if you get a lot of those kinds of stories.
So that's the sort of thing that's so specific. I would have loved to have had that information for the book. The event that the caller is probably referencing happens during the summer of 1813. Some people don't know that Battery Park here in Burlington gets its name from a War of 1812 encampment that the colonel at the time, Isaac Clark, set up early in the war. And Clark's here in Burlington, and he's up in Swanton. And during the summer of 1813, the British enter Mequon Bay. They raid into Swanton, and their objective is to burn a barracks that is basically located in the area of Grand Avenue in Swanton. And that is a project that I've worked on a little bit with my students, trying to find the exact location of that barracks. But the information that the caller gave kind of cements the story, because we think we know kind of the path that the British took into town, where they crossed the Missisquoi River, where they would have burned the barracks, and the route back.
It's fantastic to get that call from Milton and Swanton talking about so much history through the centuries. That's really amazing that he's able to trace that back to that musket. What was it like for most of the families in Vermont, in the northwestern section of the state, when the British soldiers did come around? I mean, was it extremely violent? Were there incidents of deaths, or was it more like the kind of thing where, you know, they may not have been as enthusiastic about this war as many of the Vermonters were not so enthusiastic about it?
It depends on which or how much of a level you want to get into. I think generally speaking, people in southern Vermont favored the war, I think, because they were farther away from the Canadian border. I think people closer to the border, I'd go so far as to say that many of them probably had sympathies with the Canadians and the English. And in fact, during that raid in the summer of 1813, there's some evidence that some Swanton citizens were actually cheering on the English soldiers as they burned the barracks. There's also several reports that the British soldiers themselves were less than professional, being in enemy territory. And if I could kind of give props to a source, a lot of historic newspapers have been digitized now and are available online. So when you have somebody like me who freely goes into nerd mode and wants to research this stuff, there's so many historic newspapers available online that if you can spend time sitting in front of a computer and going through a lot of old articles, and if you have the right search words, some of those newspaper stories, there were reports of at least one, maybe two rapes in Swanton while different groups of soldiers had fanned out across the town. A couple of gardens were raided. But there's also an account that during the entire Murray's Raid attack, which is that July, August of 1813, that there were as many as 16 different soldiers from the British side that had defected. That's a research vein that I haven't spent a lot of time on yet, but the number was pretty clear that the British at least noted that not all of their soldiers returned.
One of the things I find really fascinating about the book is the difference in how the newspapers covered this, especially the opinion pages, because as you said, folks who were in the southern part of the state maybe looked at, you know, some of the ambivalence of people from Swanton and some of the soldiers, and looked at it as being very unpatriotic. And I think the newspapers, a lot of op-eds reflected that, didn't they? Whereas people, you know, who were from these communities said, hey, wait a minute here. We didn't ask for this. We, you know, you've hurt us economically. All of a sudden, we can't trade with people we've traded with forever. You know, a real difference there.
There's several accounts in newspapers that are primarily from southern Vermont or from upstate New York, where they actually question whether or not Swantonians who signed depositions after the attack, if they actually could read the documents that they were signing their names to. Yeah, there was definitely some editorial slants about whether or not people should be engaged in the war, supporting the war. Take a little bit early on in the summer of 1812 into the fall of 1812, the Plattsburgh Republican and the Burlington Sentinel, they are both in favor of the war, and they're it's not the yellow journalism time period in American history yet, but they're definitely having their articles written with the slant of the Grand Army of Northern Vermont or the Grand Army of the Champlain Valley is on its way north. And then when things crumble for that assault, which I go into some detail in the book, there's not a heck of a lot of information. It's just, oh, the army's returning home.
Just before we get to a break, I want to talk a little bit after that about the Canadian view of all this and that failed incursion into Montreal. But I'm curious what a soldier who defected, let's say, from the U.S. side would do. Would they go to Canada, stay there, hide in Vermont? Is there any evidence of what happened there?
That's a research vein that I haven't gone down, but it's definitely something that is on the periphery of the stuff that I like to research. If a British soldier defected to the American side, I would think that their overall intent would be to stay in the country and done as so many of their countrymen had done before them and become an American citizen. These guys are – they had just left the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. In many cases, they're being asked to fight in the cold weather in the fall. They don't want to go into Vermont territory or New York and fight. So I think the natural decision to defect for some of those guys was maybe not obvious, but when they saw the opportunity to get away from what they were doing, they took it.
Jason Barney, the war began in June of 1812. And by fall, one of, I guess, President James Madison's goals was to have U.S. forces invade Quebec, march into Montreal, take over the city. Apparently, this was predicted to be a pretty easy invasion. But what happened instead?
The Americans always thought that they could just march north of the border and take Canada and the Montreal territories. So much so that I think it's Jefferson who's quoted that as far as conquering Canada, it's really just a matter of marching. There wouldn't be much fighting to the north. Things don't go well for the Americans from the start. There's a couple of offenses that are over in the Great Lakes area. There's a battle near Detroit, which is a disaster for the Americans. Then there's one other a little bit further west. And as you get into August, that's the time period where the barracks that had been built in Swanton, that's where Vermont militia start to get called up and deployed. And that situation is also a little weird because as you get into September and October, William Williams is the regimental commander who's up there. He actually gets accused of looking the other way as far as local citizens continuing their efforts to smuggle with the English and the Canadians over the border. There's another unit, Colonel Fifield. His soldiers are from the eastern portion of the state. They get stationed in Swanton as well. And as that first offensive, the third for the United States, gets underway, it's this time of year. It's cold, it's wet, it's rainy. The soldiers don't have a heck of a lot of winter gear. There are tensions between the Vermont militia, which would just be average men who have their musket and who maybe drill two or three times during the summertime. And there's tensions between them and the regular army soldiers who are coming in from New Jersey and from other locations. The regular army guys are stationed in Burlington and to a greater extent over in Plattsburgh. As you get into November, everybody marches north and the Vermont militia is sort of grumbling along as they do it. There's another or two or three other Vermont units, Martindale and another Williams. And they're all heading up towards the border by Rouse's Point. And it's a different time period in American history where not everybody thinks of themselves as a Vermonter or, sorry, as an American, but they do see themselves holding an allegiance to their state. Mm. So some of the Vermonters, when they reach the Alberg area and then when they go over to Rouse's Point, they refuse to cross the border. So you have this invasion force of about 5,000 U.S. soldiers and 2,500 of them, 3,000 of them are either stuck on the border or very nervous about doing that. That invasion ends up resulting in an embarrassing defeat for the Americans. It's called the First Battle of La Colle Mill. And basically, when you take a look at the details of that attack really didn't end because the British force or the Canadian force or the Native Americans were particularly large. There's a friendly fire incident on one of the mornings. And Isaac Clark, he pulls his forces back and generals Dearborn, basically they kind of give up because they I think they understood and they knew based on Revolutionary War history that if you're going to go into Canada during the winter months, you're just going to invite trouble. And in fact, they invited trouble on themselves just by trying to go that far north that late in the season anyway.
Yeah, that time of year. You know, it's funny too because you point out in the book that those soldiers who you say refused to cross into Canada to go over the border, they say that they were not required to.
Correct.
By law. Is that true?
Well, so when they sign up, when they're mustered, their primary allegiance is to the state militia that they were a part of. If somebody's a U.S. soldier, they're following their commander's orders for the U.S. Army.
And that's that tension you're talking about between soldiers maybe from New York, New Jersey, and then the Vermonters, yeah. Federal soldiers that are, you know, versus the more, I guess, amateur soldiers, if you will.
And it's not just amateur soldiers. And I know some history geeks kind of have affection for a particular general or a particular commander. I'd say the generals involved in that invasion in the fall of 1812 were kind of amateurish in their expectations. As soon as that invasion falls apart, U.S. soldiers are returning to Pike's Cantonment over in Plattsburgh and they're returning to Burlington. And there's a huge outbreak of diseases. It's a combination of pneumonia and smallpox. And some of the historical accounts are that there are hundreds of soldiers that end up dying in Burlington. Some of the accounts of the militia that I uncovered, they're returning home and they're bringing the diseases with them. Mm. So as they're returning home to their families, if they stopped at an inn in Burlington and they're on their way back to Virgins or somewhere else in the southern part of the state, they're leaving a trail of infected people behind them.
Wow.
And that disease situation is pretty bad. And there, in fact, was a reference that I uncovered from one of the Canadian towns north of the border. The diseases just did not hit the Americans. The French Canadians and the English soldiers were hit pretty hard too. So an invasion of Canada at that point in time, it was a disaster. It would have been worse if they tried to go further north.
This is a real source of pride, though, for many Canadians, isn't it? When they think about the War of 1812 or talk about it, is this something that they look at as a source of national pride?
Oh, absolutely. They should, especially with, I think, the perception that Canadians have of themselves and the perceptions I think that we as Vermonters have of Canadians. If you look at their UN work, their soldiers are deployed all over the world. And if you look at American history, you know, there aren't too many conflicts that we feel nervous about talking about or that there's not some sort of badge of honor or great battle or victories. But for what the English and the French Canadians were able to do on the Canadian border, they held off the Americans for 2.5-3 years. And, you know, the British are able to burn Washington, D.C. later on in the war. But even that is linked to local events with the Battle of Plattsburgh.
We have this research-related question from Jerry, who writes to us and asks, early Vermont newspapers are accessible from the Vermont State Archives for free. The database is via newspapers.com. He says it's searchable. Did you use this archive in your research, and is it worth looking at even if you're not writing a book? What can people find in these archives?
Oh, I would encourage anybody who just has a historical question about an era, about a family member, to try to access those. There's another one, the Northern New York Newspaper Project. Those are also online. And for me in the War of 1812, what I did is I typed in the search as a search engine the names of commanders that I was looking for, or the names of units, or the names of some of the boats on Lake Champlain, because often those would be press worthy for the newspapers of the time. And whatever I was able to do with my research for the book, I would definitely encourage anybody to make use of those newspapers online.
Speaking of names and this kind of research, I understand from the introduction to your book that you found that two ancestors of yours in the Barney family actually fought in the War of 1812.
Yeah.
Who were they? What did they do?
Well, so if I can give a little bit of history on that, my grandfather Barney, and since this is the Thanksgiving time period, one of my family's lasting memories of the guy is going up to his house in Highgate for Thanksgiving. And he had a huge wall family tree, and he had traced the Barney family line back to, I think it's 1634 or 1637 in Massachusetts. And I know my father took pride in Grandpa always having that information available. And I can always remember my grandfather was particularly proud that he had done a little bit of research and found that somebody, one of the Barneys from the Connecticut area, was mustered during the Revolutionary War. So when I got to reading the Swanton history book and kind of had this idea that I wanted to be a history teacher, I read the accounts and saw that there were two Barneys, and they were father and son, and they're one of them is stationed in upstate New York during the fall of 1813, and then the other one fights at the Battle of Plattsburgh. And I would like to think, as a 44-year-old patriotic American, that nobody from my family ever smuggled during the War of 1812. But my guess is that there probably was family tensions, because everybody was smuggling at the time. And some of these guys, yeah, they got called to duty, but I'm sure that they were looking the other way at different points.
You mentioned the Battle of Plattsburgh, and I do want to get to that in just a moment. But I am curious about this idea of, you know, the folks who maybe were doing a little smuggling, you know, in defiance of federal orders or what have you. When the effort of a lot of these soldiers who were in Swanton and other places in northwestern Vermont, when they were done, when they came home to their communities, do you know anything about what their reception at home was like? Were they looked at as, you know, was there sympathy from people in these towns saying, we know you really didn't want to do this? Or was it more of a kind of, hey, you should have been fighting harder for your country? We, you know, the United States was at war.
I think that you would find that people's reaction kind of runs the gamut. Probably the best way I can answer your question is I think it's in the Grand Isle history book that's been published. There's a reference to Vermont soldiers rushing over to defend Plattsburgh late in 1814, in September, right before the Battle of Plattsburgh. And the guys who are rushing over from Vermont, you know, they know that there's this 10,000 or 12,000 man British force coming down into New York from Canada, and they're leaving their families, and it's harvest season. And apparently the guy who owned the inn said to the Vermonters on their way over to fight the Battle of Plattsburgh, you know, I hope the British win.
Wow, really?
Yeah. So the tensions were high, and yeah, and it wasn't just smuggling. I mean, I'm sure people were vocal with their opposition to what some people probably thought is American aggression, to trying to take Canada.
What is the significance of the Battle of Plattsburgh?
It's huge. So you mentioned the burning of Washington early on. So just like the Revolutionary War, the idea that the British could use the Champlain Valley as a almost a spear or the blade of a sword to divide New England from the rest of the colonies or the rest of the states. So during the Revolutionary War, that ends in failure at the Battle of Saratoga. During the War of 1812, the British send a huge contingent of soldiers to Montreal in the spring of 1814. And the American soldiers and the American generals here in the Swanton area, they kind of don't know what's happening. They're not sure how many British soldiers are up in Montreal. A huge American force actually gets devoted over to the Niagara frontier. Hmm. So when you get into the late July time period, there aren't that many U.S. servicemen defending Plattsburgh. And it's all linked. There's a British force that goes down to Washington and burns the capital. And word of the burning of the capital had just barely reached the Vermont area as the British soldiers are crossing the border. And Vermont had a little bit of a stake in it as well, because as the British are coming down, there's also a lot of heightened naval activity on the lake. The British had been working on a very large vessel called the Confiance. And the Confiance, along with the rest of the British fleet, comes down Lake Champlain, and Isle of Mott gets occupied. They land a couple of contingents of soldiers at what would be St. Anne Shrine, the old fort area, and then they set up a battery of artillery that is facing down towards Plattsburgh. And I think one of the reasons why Vermonters react that way to the Battle of Plattsburgh is because part of Vermont had been occupied. I think there was a patriotic duty that this is it, the British are coming, the British are coming.
Right.
But once they knew or understood that part of Vermont had been occupied, that brought their response to a different level.
Jason, we just have about a minute left here, but one of the things that's always confused me about the War of 1812 was, you know, all these events you mentioned, the burning of the White House and the bigger, wider conflict. When it was all over, it doesn't seem that much really changed. And that's what's so odd about this war. I mean, Britain did not take over the U.S., didn't even take over part of it. What was the upshot of all this? How did the war end and what's its legacy?
The war ended and there's a lot of tension with the Canadians to our north. Probably the longest legacy that anybody can physically identify is the unfinished fort that sits between Rouse's Point and Alberg. That fort is locally referred to by a couple of other names, but I believe the official name is Fort Montgomery. And had history panned out the way that American military leaders thought it would, that fort was going to be in place to stop any further aggression by the British or the Canadians. They'd been invaded through the Champlain Valley twice. They didn't want it to happen again.
We'll have to leave it there. Fascinating stuff. Jason Barney is a high school history teacher at Missisquoi Valley Union High, and he's the author of the book Northern Vermont in the War of 1812. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.